All right, welcome to the class again on Anabaptist history. Glad for those of you who are here. And just by way of review, I know some of you have been here all 3 days, some of you not at all. The first day we talked about the Anabaptists that began in Europe, and since the maps are up here, the first one was in Switzerland. And the second movement was in Holland, or the Netherlands. And those were independent of each other. Come on in. And so then from Switzerland, they spread over into Austria, over into Moravia, into Germany, over Alsace-Lorraine. From Netherlands, they spread to northern Germany, Belgium, Poland. And from Poland, eventually on into Ukraine. And on up into Russia. And so that was our first day. Now the second day then, yesterday, we talked about the migrations of the different ones of the Mennonites from Europe to America. And we started over here in 1683 and went all the way to 1943. 8 major waves of immigration. The first wave was some Dutch, some Swiss. The second wave was mainly Swiss of Mennonite persuasion and a few Amish. The third was almost all Amish, and that would have been Swiss in background. The fourth wave, I'd have to look at that a little bit again, but I think that was a lot Swiss. And the fifth wave here, only 300. I think that was mainly Swiss. Then we get to the sixth wave. 400 Swiss and 18,000 Dutch, which would have come out of Russia. Then the seventh wave was right about the time of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. 21,000 of the Russian Mennonites moved to Canada. And then right after World War II, about that time there was a eighth wave where there was a number that went to Canada, and I think there was about 5,000 at that time went to South America, to Uruguay and to Brazil. And so we find then that the Anabaptist movement started in 1525, and then about here, we start coming over to America. It's 1693, which is just a little bit after the first wave, the Amish division. We're going to follow that just a little bit in America. And of course, we have the Mennonite line here. So hopefully we can get most of this covered. I guess I better, you want to just start this, take one pass on back. So, today now, we want to talk about tracing the various branches of the Mennonites and Amish in America. And I was just mentioning here that the book that is written about the Mennonites in Oregon is entitled Apart and Together. And we probably could entitle this whole thing today Apart and Together. There's just been a lot of divergence. I was going to start... Kind of forgot about this. When I was just a newly married man, there was a man that I was working with in the seed warehouse. Interesting man, a little over me, and he said, "Now what church do you go to?" And I said, "Well, I'm Mennonite." "Oh, okay, yeah." He said, "The Mennonites." He said, "They have the most denominations of any church, any group except the Baptists. The Baptists have 28, the Mennonites have 27. So maybe we'll talk about a few of those here today. And that kind of, I don't know if he was right or wrong, never stopped to figure that out.
Okay, what we want to do now is start with the Mennonites that came to America and a few of the Amish, and a little bit what their life was like. And when they came to Pennsylvania, Penn's Woods, they had to clear the land, they had hard work. They put themselves, even though they were so thankful for the freedom that they got, they had to put themselves to hard work to just eke out an existence. I think I mentioned yesterday that most times in those earlier days, church service was once every 4 weeks. They'd have to hitch up the horse or walk, depending how far they had to go. And so their religious life began to wane a little bit. Come on in. Because they did not have the structure in place church-wise for that. Let's see, I think I got another. There you go. But like I said, they were thankful for religious freedom, and I mentioned this yesterday. My father was a minister in the church, and I remember him praying and thanking the Lord for that we can meet unhindered and unmolested. A carryover from the pioneer days. All right, now I'd like to talk just a little bit about the worship services that they held every 4 weeks. And I've got somewhere here. I'm not going to read it all, but just a few things. One reason I want to give this is because this very thing was the type of thing that some of the traditional Amish and Mennonites wanted to keep, and the more progressives felt like there was a lot of spiritual value there. So I'd like to tell you just a little bit about what a church service is like, and see how we would do with that. So it says, when the time came for the service to begin, one of the song leaders would announce a hymn which he led without arising. He would estimate the pitch, and he would begin to sing. And the people all joined in heartily, singing how? Joel, how are you singing here today? At least four parts, if not eight. How many parts were they singing then? One. It was a melody. But they sang lustily. The four-part singing did not really come into being until about the time of the Civil War. All right. It says here, in the Lancaster congregations, the ministers did not enter the service until the congregation had sung several hymns, perhaps reminiscing of the days of persecution. It is evidently safe to join the group, for no officers have appeared to arrest us. Now, isn't that interesting? So they would stay out until everything seemed to be safe. That's what they did in Europe, and then they would go in. I was reading that one time. Probably a lot of you know Glenn Bender. You know him. He was a Amish bishop. And then a bishop in the Bethel group, and lives at Nebraska now. He said, "Oh," he said, "so that's why the Amish, the ministers, don't go in until after the church is started. That's a carryover from Europe." And he found that very interesting. So, see, a lot of these things that were brought into being because of necessity. And part of the singing was necessity. Okay, then what would happen? I didn't get there yet. But the minister would line the line of the song, say it, and then they'd sing it. And then he'd line the next two lines, and they'd sing it. Why was that? Was that more spiritual? Was that more right? So, well, no, they didn't have enough books. But some of that stuff needed to be carried on over into some of the forms of worship, which we'll hopefully get to here a little bit later. After the lining and singing of the hymn, the deacon took a Bible and read a chapter from a seated position. And Then one of the ministers would give a brief address, and they called that the opening. After the opening, then there was everyone would kneel down, face backward, and have prayer. But that prayer was silent. And then after the silent prayer, they would get back up. And then there would be a sermon, about an hour-long sermon. And then at the end of that sermon, then they would kneel again, and the minister would pray. Then there was the other ministers in presence and would get up and give testimony, whether they agreed with what was said and so on. After that was done, then the minister that had preached the message, he would get up and thank them for their comments and ask the congregation, to stand. Let me see. In the Franconia was different than in the Lancaster. Which was it now? It doesn't matter. It says, the minister who preached then arose, expressed appreciation for the testimonies, called the congregation to another kneeling prayer. And then the congregation sang a closing hymn. A benediction was pronounced, with the Franconia congregations remaining seated and the Lancaster congregation standing. So they had a little difference in their practices there. And they closed with the Lord's Prayer. And the minister would say, go in peace. Now just tuck that in the back of your mind, because when we get over here to this area right here, that some of that became very important. Do any of you have old order background? Okay. Have any of you been like to a Whistler service or okay? You have? I guess I was asked to preach one time at the Whistler Church in Michigan. And this all sounded so familiar, how this is done. So the bishop told me, now just follow me, we're going to go up and do what I say. Okay, so sit there. And so he gives out a song, and he lines it, and we sing it. And then they give out the chorister gives out another song, and he says, read the first two lines. I said, me? Yeah. Now? Yeah. and that's kind of the way it went. But this whole thing that I read just sounded so much like their church service. And so that was interesting. All right. So now let's go on to the establishment of conferences in the Mennonite churches. The Amish did not really have conferences as such. So we have the Franconia Conference and the Lancaster Conference. And they, according to what I read, for about the first 100 years, they were the only two conferences in America. And yet there were daughter conferences that came off of that. And if you have that first, page on the handout, and this would have been as of 1903. There's a number of conferences listed. Franconia, Lancaster, Washington, Franklin, Virginia, Ontario, Southwest Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Illinois, Missouri, Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, Alberta, Saskatchewan. But those first two, they were the first conferences. And you see, this was not really a carryover from Europe. In Europe, they did not function under a conference structure as such. And so it was a little bit questionable, was this the way to go? But they found in the new setting there was a lot of value in meeting together as leaders of the churches in their various regions and helping one another. And decisions were made, decisions were handed down, and so on. One thing, I feel like this here is just a little bit, it doesn't portray Oregon very good. Kansas, Nebraska, Oregon was in that conference at this point. About 2 or 3 years later, there was a Pacific Coast Conference that was formed here on the West Coast, Oregon, Idaho, so on. So that kind of covers the conference. Does anybody have any questions or comments or anything before we go any further? All right, my next section is other Mennonite groups that were formed. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, although I think they should be mentioned. There was a group that became the Reformed Mennonites, another Stauffer Mennonites. If I understand right, they would still be in existence today. And those of you from Pennsylvania maybe know more about them. And they would have taken more of a conservative position and felt like the church was slipping in some of these areas. But you see, the Reformed go clear back to the War of 1812, right? I mean, 1812 there, and 1845, Jacob Stauffer. But then in the Franconia Conference, there was a younger man who was ordained minister by the name of John Overholser. And he was a very progressive thinking man. And they were supposed to wear the regulation coat, which is what we would call the plain suit today, and he refused to do it. No, I'm not going to do that. But here he was ordained. What are we going to do about it? Okay. All right. He doesn't sound familiar. So, and then he had some ideas. He felt that the conference could be organized in a much better way. He felt that minutes ought to be taken. He felt that he wrote a constitution for the Franconia Conference. I guess you'd say the Franconia. At least that's where he was. He had been a school teacher. He was a very intelligent person. Well, finally, he and about 16 other ministers, including one bishop, was disenfranchised from the Franconia Conference because of their progressive ways. And they begin to meet separately. And there's a story behind that whole thing. But they became known then as the General Conference Mennonites. I don't know if you've... Now, that's a little different than the general conference of the conferences, but the general conference Mennonites. And so they took a much more, I guess I'd say, a liberal track. They dropped distinction of attire. They dropped eventually military involvement in military or keeping from that. They allowed marriages between them and non-Mennonites, just a number of things. And so that became a fairly large group throughout the nation. And it might not have become such a large group, except that there were quite a number of these, I think, the 18,000 that came from Russia that would have joined with them. And so they were a fairly large group. Here about, I don't know, 20 years ago maybe, the General Conference of Mennonites and the Mennonite Church merged into the USA of America. So those two groups have merged again. John Holdeman, I think probably most of us would know of the Church of God in Christ Mennonite. We call them Holdemans. He felt that the church was digressing, was becoming too liberal, and he started a fellowship. And there again, that probably would have just about died out had it not been for the Mennonites that came from Russia. A lot of them identified with the Holdeman group. Okay, so now let's go to let's go down the street here a little ways. And we have, okay, here we have the first Great Awakening in New England. And over here we have the second Great Awakening. And I think it was probably the second one that affected the Mennonites more than the first. But there were very outstanding preachers that would have been revivalistic. And they were dynamic speakers. Well, you know, these young people, these Mennonite young people, they were used to going to church and hearing German and hardly being able to understand it, because the Mennonite services were held in German. Not even the Pennsylvania Dutch that they would have might have been used to talking. And so some of these young people would go to a neighboring church, and they would hear this dynamic preaching, and it stirred them, and they were converted, and they said, wow, this is something that we need. And the church was beginning to lose all kinds of its young people. And they were zealous young people. It's interesting, and I should have brought that. I knew I didn't have much time, but it's interesting to read on the camp meetings. And the Methodists were especially great on that. And the camp meetings, they'd have a big camp out, a big party, you might say. And if I understand right, they'd be on the grounds where maybe there'd be three or four different preachers preaching, and there would be people hallelujahing, and it was quite an emotional event. And so if any of the Mennonite preachers began to preach with a little bit of enthusiasm, they were accused of being Methodists. And so what are we going to do with this? Here are young people who are going off. They're following this. And they're finding spiritual fulfillment. And yet we're trying to maintain some of the value of the Anabaptist position. And so there got to be quite a difference of opinion there. Another thing, point two there, is the Sunday schools. And that's another whole study. I mean, we could spend a whole session on that and not near get done. But the Sunday schools started in England, and it started as a way to reach some of the orphans, I think, in London, some of the children on the streets. And it came to America. And it seemed like there was some value in teaching in a Sunday school. Now, today, we just kind of accept Sunday school, most of us do, that's the way it's always been. Can anyone tell me what was the big concern, some of the major concerns about Sunday school in those days? Anybody know?
The father was supposed to teach.
Okay, the father was supposed to teach. That's good. And see, the opposition to this was not just in the Mennonites. I mean, it was in the Lutherans, it was in the Presbyterians, but eventually they began to do it. But what happened was they had what they called union Sunday schools. And so we're going to have a union Sunday school, we're going to have a Presbyterian, we're going to have a Methodist, and we're going to have a Baptist as teachers, and we're going to all be together, and we're going to have, guess what, Protestant literature as our study material. And it's for all the children in the community. Come on! Well, the Mennonite children came. They were influenced, and some of them, they liked their Episcopalian teachers. They must have a good church. So there was quite a resistance among the Mennonites to that. All right. Then I have here the evening services. And the evening services, one thing it was really spoke against was protracted meetings. What are protracted meetings? Anybody know?
Like evening after evening?
Evening after evening. More than how many evenings? More than two. Now, some of our children would like that. If we could keep it to two. But anyhow, but see, what had happened, evening services were not typical up until about the mid-1800s. And there's a reason for that. Because whale oil did not burn very good, make very good light for a service. But when the kerosene lamps came in, that made a difference. Then it was light enough that we could have a service. And so that changed things there. Okay, I think I've pretty well already covered point B there, youth and children attending other denominations. And so in the Mennonite church then, there was a concern that many were losing what they call the old ways. And part of the old ways is what I read to you to begin with there, as far as the form of the worship service. That wasn't all of it, that was part of it. And so there were, you might say, visionary men that said, you know, we have got to provide some things for our churches, for our youth, so that they can get a hold of the truths of the gospel and carry them forth. And the church needs to be revitalized. And so we come here to we have the Second Great Awakening. And here Sunday School comes to America. Maybe I don't have it on here, but there's what we call the Great Awakening of the Mennonite Church. I don't see, maybe I didn't put that on there. That's all right. But it's in that general time frame. And so what is interesting is that both in the Amish and in the Mennonites, there were old order groups that were formed during this time. First of all, let's follow the story of the Amish. I guess that second sheet there on conferences, you can look at that sometime. Okay, so let's look at the Amish in America, and then we want to look at the Mennonite side of things. So first of all, the first Amish that came to America was in 1720. There was a congregation established in 1749. And then from 1720 to 1756, there were several hundred that migrated to America. We covered that yesterday. In 1810, there were some that went from Somerset, Pennsylvania to Holmes County, Ohio. In 1840, some went from Somerset County and Holmes County to Elkhart and LaGrange County, Indiana. And then we have that great big influx of Amish, 3,000 of them from 1815 to 1860. And if you remember the chart that I showed you yesterday of my ancestors, of my four streams, what do you want to call it, of ancestors, three of them came to America during that time period as Amish. Okay. And they came, most of them, not into Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was already full. So they came to Ohio and Indiana and Illinois and Michigan, New York, and so on. Now, let's just think about this a little bit. So you have some Amish that would have immigrated in the earlier time, and they were pretty well settled in. They were pretty traditional in Pennsylvania, maybe in Ohio, some of them. And then you have a whole other influx of Amish from Europe about 100 years later. Are their practices going to be the same? You think about that today. Let's say that someone immigrate from here to wherever, Norway. Say you're going to go to Norway. And we're going to send about 200 people, and then 100 years from now, some more of us from the Willamette Valley, we're going to go to Norway too. Are the practices going to be the same? There's probably going to be some differences. And that's basically what happened here. And so you had in the East a more traditional, a more solid group of Amish. In the Midwest, they were more what we call change-minded. That's a nice word for liberal, I guess. And now, you'll notice the next thing here, and this is something I didn't realize till a few years back. The first stream baptism in 1848. Now, what's the big deal about stream baptism? So, let's see here. In the 1840s, in the late 1840s, there was trouble in the Worcester congregation in Wayne County, Ohio. In 1848, Bishop Christian Schantz took 8 young people to a stream at their own request and baptized them as they knelt shoe deep in water. At the same time, he baptized 8 other persons in the traditional way in the house. And this opened up a whole big controversy. Stream baptism. Go baptize people in the stream. And that got to be the defining point between the traditionals and the change-minded. And it wasn't so much that was such a big issue itself, except that kind of showed what side of things you were on. And so later on, those who took the position of wanting the stream baptism, if you follow that those groups on through, those churches basically were built, developed close to a creek, close to a place where they get baptized in the stream. Becky, you're from Harrisburg. You've probably heard of the baptisms in the Muddy Creek. Is your church close to a creek?
It is.
It is. And they used to baptize right across the road there in the creek because they were lineal descendants of this. And so that was true in many places. It's very interesting that what were known later as the Amish Mennonite, when there was a division, they pretty much found themselves where they could baptize in the stream because that was a really important thing. It's kind of gone by the wayside. Okay, so the change-minded Amish, they took up various practices that deviated from the old traditional ways. Meeting houses, and it was no longer necessary for the preachers to go in a separate room before the church service. They dropped that. And they had a hymn book. They kind of dropped the old Osborne hymn book and they got new fast tunes. Prayer book was no longer needed. There was more pride in personal appearance. Houses had splendid furnishings. And they required the new birth before baptism. Imagine that. They introduced protracted evening meetings. They started Sunday schools. And then they began to have outreach and evangelism. Some of this sounds good, doesn't it? So there got to be some meetings here. What are we going to do about this? Here we have the change mind, here we have the traditional. And so they began to get together and they had some conferences, not really conferences we would know it, but some conferring together. In about 1862 to 1865, let's see, 1862 to 1865, and what was happening in the world right then? Civil War. But in the notes from those meetings, I don't think there's anything mentioned about the Civil War. But that's the time frame that they were having these conferences. Well, there was a schism that developed there. It was irreversible. And so there were several groups that came out of that. The one is what we know as Old Order Amish. The other was known at that point as Amish Mennonite. And then there were two other groups that came out of that. There was the Eglie Amish in Indiana, which became known as the Defenseless Mennonites, and later the Evangelical Mennonites. And then there was the Stuckey Amish of Illinois, and they joined the General Conference Mennonites. The Amish Mennonites then formed 3 regional conferences. There was one that was in Ohio and Pennsylvania. There was the Indiana, Michigan. And there was a Western District. And the Western District was from Illinois all the way to the West Coast. And so the churches in Oregon that were Amish, were the old orders weren't here, but the Amish Mennonites, they were a part of the Western District of the Amish Mennonite Conference. So then in the 19, early 1900s, 1920s, those three conferences basically merged with the Mennonite Church and became Mennonite. All right. Now, we find that here, in 1916 to 1927. So then there were some independent churches that did not go along with the Old Order Amish, but neither did they join up with the conferences. And they wanted to kind of get together, and there was, I don't know if I've got that here or not, but there was, In 1910, there were several Amish Mennonite churches that had never become part of the conference, and they felt a need for closer fellowship. There were 16 ordained men in 1912 from Maryland, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Iowa, and Missouri. And they got together and said, we need to work together. And they formed a conference called the Conservative Amish Mennonite Conference. You've probably heard of the Conservative Conference. Not too conservative today anymore. But it started back in the, 1912, I think it was. So then we go to Pennsylvania, and there was quite a bit of feeling. This idea of banning and shunning those who left the Amish church didn't go away. So there was a bishop by the name of Moses Beachy, and there were some that would have left there and gone and joined with a conservative conference. And there were those that said, we've got to ban these people. He said, no, that's not necessary. It's not the right thing. And that got to be such a point of contention that Moses Beachy left the Old Order Amish and began the Beachy Mennonite Church. Or not the Beachy Mennonite, I think it was Beachy Amish Mennonite. So I know that you'd like for me to take the Beachy thing from 1927 to almost 100 years later. We don't have time to do that today. That just gives you an idea of where the Beachies come into the picture in the Amish setting. Okay, now, we need to move along then to the Mennonite church divisions. Maybe go back to the, first of all, to the leaders of the Mennonite Great Awakening. We have John Funk and John Kaufman and John Brenneman and Daniel Kaufman, and the major issues, we've talked about that, most of that, Sunday school, revival meetings, missions, English preaching, and higher education. And John Funk was a younger man that came into Indiana there at the Yellow Creek congregation. If you go back a page, you'll find Jacob Whistler. He was a bishop there. John Funk came in as a minister. And there was a difference of opinion as to how they ought to approach this. You know, do we have revival meetings? Should we work towards Sunday school? And so that got to be a point of contention there. I'm going to read this here. It says, the Old Order Mennonites is a term applied to certain conservative groups that separated from the Old Mennonite Church between 1872 and 1901. They have tried to maintain the old order of customs in worship and in church life. They were concerned about the church using new innovative methods, borrowing from groups that did not uphold the doctrine of non-resistance. And so the first old order division took place in Indiana, and it was there, Jacob Whistler and his group that wanted to keep the old ways. And basically it would have been John Funk and John Kaufman that would have promoted the other way. Have any of you ever read the book, His Name is John? His name was John. Okay. About John Kaufman. Very interesting book. He was a man that was very gifted, very talented. He had a burden for the Mennonite church. He traveled all over the Midwest to small churches. He preached. He tried to be very careful not to offend those who felt there should not be protracted meetings. So he'd have two meetings here. He'd have two meetings there. Two meetings there. But he was a very dynamic speaker. He was very personable and kind of broke down the resistance to revival meetings. And there were many people who were converted under his preaching. And the one man that was converted under his preaching we have on here is Daniel Kaufman. Daniel Kaufman was converted under the preaching of John Kaufman. And Daniel Kaufman became a very staunch promoter of Bible doctrine. If you have the Bible doctrines of the Bible, or the doctrine of the Bible, he would have written that. My father would have talked about Daniel Kaufman. He said he was a man of few words, but what he said counted. And one day at the Fairview Church here at Albany, they were having some conference. I think it had to do with, they were talking about something to do with literature or printing or something. And he said, there was this person that had that to say, and something else, somebody else would have something else to say. And they were going back and forth. Daniel Kaufman just sits back there and listens. Finally, he says, I'm not interested. End of story. He carried a lot of weight. But he was a very gifted man. Daniel Kaufman, before he was converted, was headed to politics. He was headed for, I think, representative in Missouri. But when he was converted, the Lord got a hold of him. He was a dynamic man. All right. So then, if we have kind of the same thing repeating itself, not just in Indiana, but there was Ontario in 1889. There was Pennsylvania in 1893, and in Virginia in 1901. Going back to Ontario, they were known then as the Woolwich Mennonites because of their location. Out of that, in 1917, came the David Martin Group, and in 1931, the Markham Waterloo Conference. And if there's anybody with Ontario connections, I think those would all make sense to you. In Pennsylvania, Jonas Martin's group became known as the Weaverland Conference. And then in 1926, the Hornings would have come out of that. And am I correct? Is that what we would have known as Black Bumper? Black Bumper, okay. And then in 1927, the Winger Mennonites. And in 1901... there was another group in Virginia. All right. Any questions or comments on? I know I've covered this very rapidly, way too rapid. The Older Movement in Lancaster affected about 1/3 of the Weaverland Groffdale district. One of the historians of the Old Order group said this, Isaac Horst said this. He says, of Funk and his followers, there was indeed a need for something, but whether it was prayer meetings, protracted meetings, and Sunday school, or discipline, obedience, and discipleship is a matter of personal opinion. So there you have the two things. On the one hand, let's have prayer meetings. Let's have revival meetings. Let's have Sunday school. On the other hand, let's keep the old ways of discipline and obedience and discipleship. Just about all of the conferences, and we just skipped over these conferences here, but most of the conferences would have experienced a certain amount of that unrest. The Franconia Conference and the Washington Franklin County Conference, they moved very slowly in allowing Sunday school and did not really experience that old order division. Although the Franconia experienced a couple liberal schisms. So I just like to say something here just on a personal level. You know, I can appreciate many of the concerns of the old orders. I didn't necessarily agree completely where they came out. But you know, they saw dangers of ecumenism in the Sunday schools. And they opposed the excesses of the revivalistic methods of their day. But you know, as any group, they made some unwise choices. But you know, as we look at history,
and we find out here where the most of the Mennonite church ended up very liberal, apostatizing and so on, you can appreciate that there were some of these who helped to maintain conservatism.
Just in case you wondered,
this chart was made basically for Bible school, and so that's one reason I have the Bethel Fellowship and the Western Fellowship. Your back page has what I've just listed as the Conservative Fellowship conferences. Kind of interesting to see those, and of course that does not cover like the Bee Gees and a lot of others.
Okay, so it's pretty obvious to me that the old orders preserved an element of biblical practices that the mainline church has lost. And they have been very much involved in some of these conservative churches today. Now, I think we are ready for the last point. All right. Numerous churches leave the Mennonite conferences to form groups endeavoring to regain lost scriptural practices. So in the late 1950s and the early 60s and on, there were almost in every conference, I think, in America, there were churches that said, you know what, things are going too far. We need to get back to the ways of that our forefathers had done. So there was quite a movement. And they begin to regain, and that's that list there and on the last page of the printout. And so one thing I've found in studying the church history like this, first of all, I might just say, when we see the results of the acculturation in the 19th and 20th centuries and see how soon a church can lose its doctrines and its practices, where do we want to be? What direction do we want to go? And so as I've looked at history of the Mennonite church, it seems like the difference between those who have kept a more consistent practice and those who have just kind of let things go is a matter of discipline. Church discipline. And that, we don't like that term very well. David Luthy, he was an Old Order Amish historian, said this: "Admonishment, as contrasted with discipline, is a key word in understanding the Amish Mennonite and the Mennonite pattern of drifting. Conference, resolutions, and admonishment lack the teeth that the Old Order discipline had. Today it constitutes the vast gulf between Old Order Amish and the Mennonites, with whom the Amish Mennonites united." He goes on to say that the Amish Mennonites retained rigid regulation and severity of discipline for a time. And then the Mennonite Encyclopedia says this: "Mennonite history has often proved that proper church discipline combined with good pastoral work and effective preaching produces a wholesome church administration and leadership, which makes for a strong and vigorous church with high standards in contrast to a church without discipline when each does that which is right in its own eyes." I thought that was well put. So that's kind of where I'm just going to bring this to, that what are we going to do with this? These are things that happened, and they're still happening today. And you have a wide range of practices here in America, and where do we want to be? All right, I think that brings us to the end. Anybody have a thought, a question, a correction? Good, I must have covered it all well. All right, I think that'll be it, and thank you for your attention.